Today on Maine Calling, uncertainty for refugees and asylum seekers in Maine. In the past 3 years, more than 2,000 refugees and asylum seekers moved to Maine, most of them aided by a federally recognized resettlement agency, such as Catholic Charities or Maine Immigrant Refugee Services. Last week, the Trump administration suspended funding to these resettlement agencies. The question now, what do they do? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn what is happening on the ground to respond to this recent order. How are agencies working to help recent arrivals without funding? What are the legal implications of this and other Trump administration deportation orders? How has all of this changed the lives of Maine's immigrants? We'll also learn about a new documentary film about Sanford's experience with a surge in asylum seekers. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn, and by Maine Health, where care teams provide expert, coordinated care focused on your overall wellness to help you be your healthiest self. MaineHealth.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Recent executive orders issued by the Trump administration affect refugees and other immigrants in Maine. Today, we're going to talk about those, and we're going to learn about a new documentary about asylum seekers in Sanford. My guests today are Moon Mashar, who immigrated from Eastern Africa and is a program manager for MANA, Maine Association for New Americans. She's also a documentary filmmaker and mental health advocate. Anna Welch is a professor at UMaine School of Law. She is also managing co-director of the Cumberland Legal Aid Clinic, and it's in that capacity that she's speaking today. And Rilwan Osman is executive director of the Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services. We invite you to join the conversation. You can send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us today. Rilwan, I'll start with you. What has this suspension of funding for refugee resettlement agencies meant for your agency? Is all funding gone now? What are you facing?
So it's not only our agency, it affected all the resettlement agencies across the country, and the stop order ceases or stops all resettlement program, RMP program for individuals that came within the last 90 days. So we get an order on the stop order on the 24th of January that directs us to stop any services to those individuals. And these individuals came in this fiscal year. So a majority of them came in December and the first 2 weeks of January.
So first of all, how many people does this affect in your agency? How many people came in December in the first 2 weeks of January?
In our agency, we have 110 individuals that we resettled through the RMP program.
And so this means that you're not able to give them any kind of support, these people who have just arrived in Maine, correct?
Yes, yeah, we had to lay off the staff who were directly working with these individuals, with these families.
What are they doing now? How are they surviving?
So we still have to, again, we have a moral obligations, and we appeal to the public, and we're still appealing to the public to support. We have volunteers who are helping us. We have staff members who said, I will continue supporting these individuals, because a lot of them are in a temporary housing that still need support, that still need to be fed three times a week, that need housing, that need help with employment. So it's just coming together as a community to support these families who desperately need our support.
And how many people were you expecting to be bringing in the end of January, beginning of February? How many people are not coming to Maine that you were expecting to be helping?
The first week the 24th, after we get that order, this that Monday, the whole week we were expecting a lot of individuals. All those flights were canceled, and our organization was approved to resettle 350 individuals this fiscal year. So we got 110. So that means the remaining refugees who are approved, vetted again by the government, will not be coming, as we know right now. So.
So more than 200 people approved, vetted by the government, and had travel plans to come to Maine, and that is not happening now. Anna, I want to turn to you. This cancellation of funding for refugee resettlement programs was not the only change in policy in the past 2 weeks. What are some of the others that have had an immediate effect on refugees and asylum seekers in Maine?
First, just thank you so much, Jennifer, for having me here today. And just a quick note that I'm speaking today in my individual capacity and not on behalf of the law school or the University of Maine school, University of Maine. So yeah, we've seen a flurry of executive orders coming out of this administration beginning on day one. A number are impacting immigrants more broadly, but I'm happy to focus initially on those that are impacting refugees and asylum seekers. So there's really two that have a dramatic impact on refugees. The one that you just mentioned, which is the, stop work orders for refugee aid organizations both abroad and in the United States. But the other one, on January 20th, President Trump signed essentially a refugee ban that halted refugee resettlement to the United States. It wasn't supposed to take effect for a week, but ultimately, we saw almost immediately that flights were being canceled and refugee cases abroad were being stopped in terms of the processing of those cases. The executive order requires a report every 90 days that the president is supposed to review, but it's essentially up to the president and that's in the interest of the United States whether to resume our refugee resettlement. And then there's some other executive orders that impact asylum seekers, so those who are seeking to come into the United States who meet the definition of a refugee, folks who have suffered persecution or have a fear of persecution if they were to return to their home countries.
Moon, all of this flurry of orders, this big change all at once, what does this mean for the families you know? Not just those who are recent arrivals, but also people who have lived in Maine for a while.
I think for me, my family moved here in 95. And so when we have really embraced this community and really started to begin to see ourselves as African Mainers and really take pride in the state, when these type of rhetorics and these conversations come up, it's still against us as a family. Whether a family arrived here yesterday or they arrived here in 95, the fear and the need for safety is the same. And so I still see the anxiety. I mean, I still feel it within my family, but then even more now because the families and the situations that are being talked about in the news lives very real in our homes. And the fear of being sent back and no clear really criteria to who is safe also causes a lot of anxiety because right now I don't think it's just specifically the ones who are recently entering. I feel like everyone feels like they're in danger.
Does that affect the way people are living their lives, Moon? Are people hesitant to leave their homes?
Yes, I would say that's definitely affecting people's lives. I think the most alarming way that I have seen, and the kind of heartbreaking way, is at the school bus, even down to the children who are starting to recognize and ask me questions because they know that I'm a storyteller and I advocate for immigrant and asylum voices. If they're going to be sent back, and the jokes that get made against individuals who come from different countries have started to become a lot more sinister and a lot more real. And when you see the fear really begin to manifest itself in somebody who's 8 years old and 10 years old, I mean, it really, really causes concern.
Rilwan, I want to ask you, the people who have come here recently, the people that the refugees you've helped, where are they coming from? What countries?
All around the world, we have people coming from Congo. We have people coming from Afghanistan. A lot of them are SIVs. That means they
And
work.
those mean people that helped American troops during the war. Okay, go on.
Yes, yeah. Worked with the U.S. Government, and they have been we have been resettling them here. The majority of them are Afghans, and we had People coming from Venezuela, we have people coming from again Congo and Ethiopia and other parts of the world. So
Okay, and what about Moon was talking about this fear. I know a big part of the work you do is try to help people get a job. Are people going to their jobs? Are they afraid to go to their jobs?
The fear is there, and a lot of people are afraid, and because again, a lot of the people that we resettled have been here less than 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and again, coming here, they were told and that they're going to be safe. There is nothing they have to fear anymore, and then coming here, and then with all this fear coming in, a lot of them are asking questions like, "What is going to happen to us right now? How are you going to support us? How are you going to help us even get employment?" So, those are some of the questions that we're getting, and we kept telling them we will continue supporting you regardless, and we will help you connect with employment. But again, the fear of, again, as Moon say, that who's at risk, who's going back, who's going to be taken away, is regardless of if you're here through resettlement a few weeks ago or if you've been here for 5, 10, 20 years. So the fear is in the community, and people are living in that uncertainty of what is going to happen today, or what is going to happen to me, or even to family members or my neighbor.
Anna, Rowan is talking about people that his federally recognized agency is helping to resettle, people who've been vetted by the government. Another conversation is happening about the Trump administration saying that it's going to be finding people that do not have papers and deporting them. Have you seen any of that happening yet in Maine?
No, I think what the important point is, yes, there's understandably a lot of fear in the community. I think as of now, we have not seen an uptick in immigration enforcement in the state of Maine. And so that's just a really important point. I know there's a lot of fear in the community. I've talked to parents who are afraid to send their children to school. My understanding is that I think all of the superintendents around the state have said that they will comply with our federal laws, which require that kids are, regardless of their immigration status, have a right to go to our public schools. There also are federal policy privacy laws that prevent our schools from disclosing confidential information about the students who are and parents of students who are enrolled in the school. So I think it's just really important for our community to know that schools remain safe in that respect, and that the superintendents have all said that absent a judicial warrant, right, a warrant signed by a judge, they are not allowed to. ICE does not have access to their student population. So I think that's just a really important point. But yeah, I think to your question, we have not seen an uptick. Does that mean that we will not know? President Trump rescinded a prior policy of the Biden administration with respect to enforcement priorities, where the Biden administration was focused on folks who had more serious criminal or immigration violations, recognizing that of the 11 to 13 million people who are here, there's neither the will nor the ability to deport everyone. So we'll focus on, a certain population. That has been rescinded. So, of course, everyone is potentially at risk. But again, in Maine, we have not seen an uptick.
Moon, even though there has not been an uptick, I understand that rumors are flying everywhere. Tell me about what those rumors are and what they're doing to the community.
Absolutely. I think the rumors are the ICE rumors and where they're being seen, and they're constantly being shared on social media. And so there is a lot of some fear mongering that could go on around it. And so, but it's still real for the community because they are so fearful. And so that type of information becomes dangerous, and it kind of does become a weapon that then stops individuals being able to live their lives in a normal way. Even from my documentary premiere that's happening, I've had people reach out and say, "Well, how are you going to make sure that ICE isn't going to enter?" And having to have that conversation, with Indigo Staff Alliance and talk about how to keep community members safe, it becomes uncomfortable because the conversation, it dehumanizes the individual. And as a storyteller, it's completely tragic to me the way that we're discussed, the way that I'm discussed, the way that my father and his dedication to want better for his family and get us to safety is discussed. Because for us, it shows real emotion and there's reverence in it. And then when you see it become this political a tool that kind of treats us like a pariah, it's tragic.
We're going to go to calls, and Greg is calling in from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Greg, go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for educating the public on this important topic. I'm a retired State Department Foreign Service officer, and I was actually the regional refugee coordinator in West Africa for a few years in the aftermath of the Liberian Civil War. I've met Moon, by the way. It was a pleasure meeting her. My daughter was doing a project, school project. I wanted to talk about the consequences of not resettling people during this suspension of the resettlement program. The reason people are refugees in the first place, as Moon can tell you on a personal basis, is that number one, they can't go back to their home country. Number two, they really can't stay where they are. Some of these refugee camps are out in the middle of nowhere and they're under duress out there. And number three, there are countries like the United States and Scandinavia, most prominently, who are willing to take refugees that have been vetted and are prepped and are ready to go. And when they can't come to the United States, it unleashes a whole chain of events. Like we've brought them to the capital city, whether it's Abidjan in my case, or maybe Nairobi in Moon's case, I'm not sure. If they can't travel, guess what? They have to go back to where they came from, which is a situation in a refugee camp that could be very dire. I mean, refugee camps are not great places to begin with. They've divested themselves of any personal items that they have because they travel with basically nothing. And there's all these hopes that have been built up. So just from the government side, it really causes problems for those of us in the field, both U.S. government and U.N. agencies who have been working together to resettle those deserving people to places like the United States.
Greg, thank you so much for your call. Anna, what would you like to follow up on what Greg said?
Yeah, I think that's such a really critical point that you're making. I also did some refugee resettlement work in Nairobi, and I know that the folks that we worked with are some of the most vulnerable people in the world. Only 1% or less than 1% of the over 43 million people who would otherwise qualify as refugees under international and US laws are resettled. So it's less than 1%. So of that, we're talking about the most vulnerable. So women and girls who are at risk, children and adolescents, survivors of violence and torture. So these folks are like, there's no alternative. They can't be returned to their home country. They cannot stay within the second or third country that they're in. They really need to be resettled. And so the consequences or the stakes are really dire. The other thing, I think the point that was made is just the vetting that these individuals go through. There's no other, I think, category of immigrants to the United States that go through more vetting. That the process takes years. I mean, literally years. I've worked with people who waited 5, 6, 10 years to get resettled. The number of background checks that folks have to go through, the medical screenings, interviews. So it's really significant, this ban on refugees coming in, and the human toll is really dire.
Greg, thanks for your call. We are going to take a break. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're discussing Maine's immigrants and asylees, the challenges they faced, and resources available to them. With me, Rilwan Osman, who is Executive Director of Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services. Moon Mashar with the Maine Association for New Americans. She's also a documentary filmmaker. And Anna Welch, a professor at UMaine, speaking personally on today's program. Share your comments and questions. Send an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Tarlan Amadoff. He is director of the Maine Office of New Americans and was formerly the state refugee coordinator. Tarlan, thanks for calling in. And I do want to disclose that you also serve on Maine Public's Board of Trustees. Thank you for that service. Hi, Tarlan.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you? Good to see you.
It's good to hear your voice. Yes. And tell me about this. The Office of New Americans is new, correct? And you just took office on January 21st. What is the purpose
Correct.
Of the office, and what are you hoping to do?
So, as you know, this office has been started on January 21st. And this is under the division of the Governor Office of Policy, Innovation, and Future. Tungopev. So we charge with the making Maine a home of opportunity for all, strengthening Maine workforce, enhancing the vibrance of Maine communities, building strong economy. You know, we have unemployment, which is recordly low, and our economic growth among the best in the nation. Maine faces a shortage of workers across regions, professions, and skills levels, so especially in this kind of critical sectors as a healthcare, education, construction. So we believe with the integrating new Americans into these sectors and making them the fully utilize their skills will make big changes for the state.
And I understand you're part of a network with similar offices in other states.
Yes, yes. So Office of New Americans is a consortium over 24 of U.S. states that provides access to expertise, experiences, and best practices to help states develop policies to support the successful economic, social, and civic integration of immigrants.
Well, Tarlan, thank you so much for calling in. Tarlan Amadoff, director of the Maine Office of New Americans. I'm going to go to an email here. This is a question from Katie. Is the fear of being targeted for deportation even extending to those who are not even immigrants, but are either African-Americans or other people of color who are born and raised here just because they look like immigrants? So, Katie, to your question, I do know that Penobscot Chief Kirk Francis recommended that Penobscot Nation members carry their tribal papers with them right now. Anna, are you hearing of anything else like that?
Yes, and I think, you know, we've heard stories, not just in Maine, I think more around the country, but of folks who speak Spanish or might otherwise look, quote unquote, like they're not from the United States being being targeted for ICE enforcement. So I think that's certainly something that it's sort of these policies are extending beyond the immigration population, but even to U.S. citizens. We are in light of an executive order that expands what's called expedited removal, so removal without a chance to be heard by a judge, to people who've been in the United States anywhere in the U.S. for less than 2 years. So we are, as advocates, encouraging folks to carry with them any proof of their status for fear that they could be caught up in sort of this dragnet.
I want to turn to you, Moon, and if somebody is feeling fearful, if somebody is wondering what their legal rights are, what resources are available?
Absolutely. So there's ILAP, obviously, is the natural place to go to get some support.
Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, ILAP. Okay, great.
Absolutely. And also immigrant organizations, CBOs right now are really stepping up and having to do the heart work, the hard work and the heart work, because it's our lived experience. We're seeing exactly what our families have gone through. And so it becomes very real for us. And if I could just go back to the question from the email around the threat of individuals who might be from here. I have never felt more weary of my diction being my defense. And so the way that I speak is going to be what actually probably will keep me safe in certain instances, because when you look at me, you don't know if I have arrived here yesterday or if I have been here for a really long time. So that in itself is a very real fear, because I've experienced prejudice from comments from individuals from the community here, from locals, who have found some frustration with our newly arriving community members and kind of generalized myself to have been one of the more recent individuals. And then until I spoke, it was when they felt a little more eased and a little humbled. But this is a very real thing.
Rowan, what would you like to add to what Moon said about resources that are available, where people can turn right now if they feel as though they need to have a sounding board?
I think community-based organizations are the best resources and only resources that these people have connection with. The people they know, the people that speak their language and from their culture are the ones who are running this organizations, and they call and ask for questions and what to do. We're getting that all the time. I think and as an organization, we explain to them again, you have to have your documentation. Even if you're a naturalized US citizen, make sure you have documentation that proves that your status in here, so that If someone stops you, at least they can verify who you are as soon as possible. And again, knowing your rights is something that, again, we are trying to explain to people. We're giving them cards, we're giving them know your rights information. Again, iLab is a great resource. And yeah, we are community-based organization, resettlement organizations, agencies are the ones that people call first when they have questions related to all this.
And Anna, I want to turn to you. When we have iLAP has been giving out Know Your Rights cards. You can find the information on their website. But very basically, what are some of these rights people may not know that they have?
Yeah, and I think that's just such an important point, as I know that there's a lot of fear, but folks in the United States have rights, and that's really an important point, and I think that hopefully should help allay some folks' fear. Right. So if you are, you know, immigration officials don't have a right to, you know, just stop you on the street and arrest you without some sort of reasonable suspicion. So for example, if they were to call you over and sort of ask who you have a right to not respond to that question. And we've put together a number of resources. The ACLU has of Maine has as well. I know iLAP has, and those resources we've shared. And we'll continue to share with our community partners. And they're, I think, as Rilwan and Moon mentioned, I think they're fantastic deliverers of this information as well in terms of what are the various rights. But the Know Your Rights cards talk about what happens if they come knocking at your door, right? You don't have to let them in unless they have a judicial warrant, so a warrant that is signed by a judge. So asking them, you know, who are you? And sometimes the ICE officers pretend that they're police. So finding out who are you? Do you have a judicial warrant? Is it signed by a police officer? Absent that, you don't need to let them in.
All right. We're going to go to Bob, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a teenage daughter, and she has a boyfriend from the Congo, and he just received a letter saying that his asylum application was accepted. And I was wondering, what does that do for him? Does that give him legal status here in America? Will he be able to get a green card? And what happens after you receive that letter?
Bob, that's a great question. Anna, do you know the answer?
Well, unfortunately, because I'm not representing this individual, I can't give any particular legal advice to this individual. I can say that I would suggest if this person doesn't have an immigration lawyer to reach out to learn more about what it means for in his particular circumstances, and I think iLAP is a great resource for that. I can speak more broadly that the asylum seekers, once you have an approval of an asylum case, you're an asylee in the United States, which means you're permitted to stay in the United States indefinitely. And after a year, you're able to apply for permanent residence. And after that, after several years, you can apply for U.S. citizenship. But again, each case is different, so I'm not able to speak specifically to that individual.
Generally speaking, though, Anna, let me ask you this. It sounds like he is not here now. Can that person with this letter get into the United States?
Oh, I was understanding that the person is in the United States. So asylum is only an option for folks.
Oh, I see. Bob, was I wrong? Is he here already?
He is here already.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Attending a local high school, yeah.
I see. Okay, great.
Okay. If I could interject.
Yes, go ahead, Moon.
Reinforced, if you can. I know that on the website, the USCIS website, if you're able to create a profile and input your number, right, you should be able to keep up with the different cases and kind of be able to kind of hover over what's going on with your case. Am I correct, Donna?
Yeah, and there's also through the U.S. Department of Justice, it's called the Executive Office of Immigration Review, EOIR. Somebody can put in what's called their alien number, which is sort of like the social security number assigned to immigrants in the U.S. Put that number in, and that's also where they can learn more about the procedural posture where their case might be.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks for your call. Now calling in is Charlie Stewart, a documentary filmmaker. His latest film is I Come From Away, An Immigrant in Maine, Part 2. It will be broadcast later this month on Maine Public Television. Charlie, welcome back, and thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jen. Thank you very much. And I would like to point out that this is really Moon's film. I directed it. And it is an extraordinary story of the city of Sanford, blue-collar, hard-scrabble town known as the city that never dies, that in May of 2023 had all of a sudden over 100 asylum seekers show up at City Hall and ask for shelter and help and food. And it is an extraordinary inside story where Moon talks to people of all political persuasions about what they did to accommodate these people, and everyone pulled together, from the police to the city administrators to the faith community to activists. And it's a wonderful look at what happens when the asylum-seeking community spilled out of Portland into an outlying city. And this is what other cities have experienced. It's really wonderful. And the one thing that is terribly sad is hearing your conversation about the fear that is installed in everyone as a result of Trump and his orders. Abel Nimi is a gentleman from Angola who Moon interviewed at the top of the film, and I'm struck by the fact that when Moon said, "How are you doing?" he said with a big smile, "I feel safe for the very first time in my life for me and my family." And he went on to get his work permit, and he is now a deputy sheriff for the York County Sheriff's Department, a typical story of asylum seekers. And now he's back to feeling fearful. It's sad. Mm. But anyway, this documentary is a wonderful tribute to the city of Sanford, and I hope people will tune in and learn how people pulled together to take care of these people.
All right. So I don't know, Charlie, if I should ask you this question or Moon this question. I understand you're particularly happy with an interview with Sanford City Manager Steve Buck.
I will leave that to Moon. I will just simply set it up by saying Mr. Buck is a man who is, as a result of being a city manager, is a very fiscally responsible individual. And it was fascinating to hear his perspective on how we had to deal with this. But it was Moon's interview, and she shines as always. I'll turn it over to her for her comments.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that before going in for the interview, first I want to thank Steve Buck for joining me and having a conversation and really like putting his heart into it and being insightful about what was going on in his city. But I, of course, you have that apprehension. You start to see some of the news headings that describe, and I already, because I moved here since 95, Sanford was a town where I personally also had a little bit of reservation just from, certain reputations that they might have or the lack of representation I saw in myself. So there was a lot of fear when I heard that this group of individuals who came from Africa were going to go to this town who probably has never seen something like that before. And so going in to interview Steve Buck, I had a certain defensiveness that was humbled as I began to talk about him and we began to humanize what was happening. And I realized that he brought himself down to a human level and really went and saw. I think one of the things that really struck my heart was when he said, well, I discovered that these are just families and they just want, a good job and they want safety. And so much of the conversation that describes and mentions forgets to say they are humans, they are innocent people, and they are good people for your economy. I think that another really, really big elephant in the room is that we are an aging state, and we really do need a kind of like a reinforcing of individuals from our workforce to social to cultural. And so being able to sit with him and kind of at the end have a completely different view really made me understand how important it is for individuals to come to the table and have the honest and hard conversations with your anxieties, with your reservations, and be willing to hear another individual out that you might think is on the opposite side of you.
Charlie, before we let you go, tell us about the screenings that are coming up and about the broadcast.
This Friday, it's probably sold out at Indigo Arts Alliance, which is a magnificent nonprofit that has supported Moon's work for many, many years. At 6 o'clock to 8 p.m., we'll be able to screen the film, and then Moon is going to have a conversation with Mafalo Chittum of Maine Immigrants' Rights, who is, I think, the single most important person in the state of Maine on this issue, and somebody that even Mr. Buck, the city manager, quoted in his interview with Moon as being the person most helpful to him and the situation in Sanford. Then I'm really looking forward to February 21st, which is probably the best opportunity for your listeners if they wanted to show up in person in Sanford. Actually, it's Springvale, a part of Sanford, at the Nasson Community Little Theater. Doors open at 5:30 on Friday the 21st to screen the film, and then to hear Moon interview Steve Buck, Jennifer Davey, who is the housing coordinator for York Community Action, and another a gentleman I've not met, who is an asylum seeker who's now working for York County Community Action. And then, of course, thanks to Maine Public, Jen, you guys have gotten behind this in a big way, showing not just this film about Sanford, but also the name of these films are I Come From Away, An Immigrant in Maine, and Part One, which aired a couple of years ago, was being repeated this month. And that's all about the hundreds of asylum seekers who came to Portland in 2019. And then Part Two, the story from Sanford, will also air. So thanks to all of your colleagues, Laura Shank in particular, at Maine Public for getting behind us on this.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much for calling in. Nice to hear your voice. Charlie Stewart, a documentary filmmaker based here in Maine. If you'd like to join this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today, Maine's refugees and asylum seekers and the situation for them right now. My guest today, Anna Welch, UMaine Law Professor with Cumberland Legal Aid Clinic, Rilwan Osman with MIRS, which is the Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services Agency, and Moon Mashar with the Maine Association of New Mainers. It's not too late. You can join the conversation. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Instagram. I'm going to go here to an email from Paul. I have friends here on humanitarian parole. They are afraid to go to their English classes. One immigrant friend is now an American citizen, but even he is afraid to travel. But the reality is a lot of what's going on is not just immoral. Some of it's illegal and needs to be challenged in court. In addition, the U.S. is tarnishing its image and standing when it reneges on contracts, agreements, and its word to people who have gone through the legal process over years and agencies entrusted to help them. New immigrants can't fight this, but the rest of us can. And Anna, I want to go to the second part of Paul's email about challenges in court. But first, I want to ask you, because he refers to his friend as somebody here on humanitarian parole, and we're also using the word refugee, and we're also using the word asylum seeker. So tell us what, for people who maybe hear these words used interchangeably, what each means, what the definition of each is.
Right. So I think that's a great question. So humanitarian parole is for folks who, you know, present at the U.S. border or apply overseas to be able to come into the United States on a temporary basis for a temporary period of time for certain humanitarian reasons. So there's different programs and we don't have time to name all of them. But, you know, there's different programs. And I think that that is one of the areas under attack by this administration with respect to you know, the long-term viability of that program. Refugees are folks who are abroad, so not in the United States, who meet the definition of a refugee under our international treaty agreements. And those are folks who have a fear of persecution, have suffered persecution, or have a fear of persecution for certain enumerated reasons. Refugees, though, have to be outside of the United States to qualify for refugee resettlement. And then there's asylum seekers. So asylum seekers are those who are physically present in the United States, regardless of how they enter the United States. And there's two different processes that they would go through. One is so what's called the affirmative asylum process through U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and another is for folks who are in removal proceedings, and that's before immigration judges under the U.S. Department of Justice. So yeah, I think it's important to know what we're talking about. I think the one other thing is what we've been talking about today is refugees, and there's some executive orders that came out that impact asylum seekers at our border. But I know there's a lot of fear in the community here in Maine about, what about me? I'm an asylum seeker. I think what's really important to know is the president cannot rewrite laws enacted by Congress. They cannot rewrite our Constitution. He cannot rewrite our international treaty obligations. So asylum seekers in the United States may still have the right to seek asylum in the United States. And as we heard from an earlier caller, those processes are still continuing.
Well, and let me ask you about this. The order that has frozen all funding to organizations such as Real Ones that help refugees, in your view, is that order legal?
Well, I think that's in litigation. I mean, I think many of us sort of agree that the president doesn't have authority to cut programs that Congress has created and funded. But I think it remains to be seen how the courts decide that case.
And I want to turn back to you, Rilwan. At the beginning of the program, you said that the way you're helping people now, these 110 people who have come and suddenly the funding has been stopped, the way you're doing that is because people have reached out with support. What kind of support have you seen so far? Are people not just helping pay for hotel rooms and things like that, but taking people into their homes? What are you seeing?
We have, we have a great caring people in the state of Maine. We have people calling and offering even people to stay at their house. We have people coming in and bringing food, people bringing clothes, people taking people to appointments, even to their kids to school enrollments and benefit enrollments. And so people are stepping in to donations to support, even feed those families in temporary housing. So again, we continue to have a lot of response from the community, and we want to thank them and with their continued support.
Do you have enough help to support these families?
I don't know if I want to say enough, but because these people, again, we are obligated to support them within 90 days. So the 90 days include is, again, finding them employment, finding them, enrolling them ESL classes, enrolling their kids into. So that is like we are in the second week or the third second week of this stop order. And again, most of them are in temporary housing. Most of them, again, will need to be fed three times a day. So again, we're getting those supports, and definitely more support is needed, especially within the next until the 90 days over. These people are relying on us. Again, they don't know anyone else in the state. The only people they know are us, the resettlement agencies in the state of Maine, which are, again, three of them. And if we stop just working with them or supporting them, then they will be lost in the state with this freezing cold weather. So,
Moon, when Charlie called in, he mentioned the first film that you and he worked on together, and that was about the large group of asylum seekers who came to Maine, 2 years ago now. And I'm wondering what you can tell me about how those people are doing. How many stayed in Maine? You don't have to have an exact number, but are they here? Do they have jobs? Give us an update.
Absolutely. I think, ironically, the programs that I developed for youth, I'm able to see the kids that I met at the expo, and they recognize me in the community because I was the woman who came with the camera. So they're in our communities. They're still here, and now they're working. They're building the infrastructure of our, of our economy. They're contributing. They're here, and they're now part of the community. And so this is what becomes disheartening, because before this recent change in administration, there was this wholesome and hopeful kind of energy and spirit in the air of celebration of all that makes us different, but how important it is for us to come together and how powerful it is for us to come together. So when this happened, how drastically the environment changed, I think was extremely disheartening, and especially when I got to see it in real time with my youth that I'm working with, you know, and they're worried for their parents because not everyone is on the same status right now. They're worried for their uncles, they're worried for their family members. Even with some of the questions, and we went to go visit the city of Portland and the mayor, a lot of their questions had to do with their security and, you know, and the stability of how the city is going to protect them and protect their families. And so the conversation changed a little bit, but those individuals are absolutely still here.
And I need to ask you, because we're also here on Maine Calling we're in the second year of a series about Maine's housing crisis. And, you know, we're talking about the Portland Expo, Portland, one of the most expensive places in the state to live. Have people been able to find affordable housing near their jobs?
That has kind of been the constant work. And the housing crisis, I think it's not even only for asylum seekers. I think across the board has been extremely, extremely difficult. And socially, it has caused a lot of tension between, you know, who's in line, who's getting help. And so a lot of that confusion and miscommunication also causes some strife within the community that I've seen. But I think that right now, the most hopeful piece of what I see is the fact that, so when I moved here in 1995, we did not have CBOs and immigrant organizations working with us. We did not have the options to be able to go somewhere where someone speaking our language and maybe came from our village or know somebody. And so that type of connection and the work that I'm able to do today that did not exist when I entered the country shows this progression that is happening, and it keeps me hopeful. I think, and as immigrants, we come from worlds of warlords, of dictators, of individuals who have tried to take our voices and our freedoms. And so there is a resilience and a spirit that can also be leaned on and learned from a lot of the communities that I think that is a potential that really needs to be tapped into, which is why I think storytelling is extremely, extremely important.
Real one.
Yeah, I think I just want to briefly talk about the contribution that the refugees bring into our state, our cities, across even the country. Of all the people that we resettle, or people who are in our communities, opening businesses, buying homes, they are contributing to the city they live in. They are contributing to the state and also to the country that they live in. So these people are determined to get job within the 90 days, determined to open businesses, determined to be homeowners and to be part of this great state that we're in and the country we're in. So I just wanted to add that.
And Anna, you wanted to add something as well.
Yeah, just quickly, I think it's well known that this administration, through all of this flurry of executive orders, seeks to, you know, stoke fear and really chaos among not only our immigrant population, but among others. And that was the stated goal. And it's been stated by officials from this administration, right, is that the hope is that folks will self-deport. We don't have the ability to deport everyone. Let's have people decide to leave on their own. So I think that's the intention. The goal is to have you be fearful. And so I think it's really just important that folks remember that they do have rights, and that we remain Maine, right? We remain a resilient, welcoming state. And I think it's fantastic. We have these, just in the few years that I've lived here, this addition of all these wonderful community-led organizations and others. So I think those are just important points for people to remember.
All right. We have just about a minute left, so I'll go to one more email. And I suspect this is for you, Anna. Can the guests respond to the recent story about the Lynn teenager who was detained by ICE and brought to Portland for reportedly arguing with her sibling? I understand from the reporting why would ICE detain a teenage girl accused of arguing, and what repercussions will this result for this ridiculous actions by ICE?
Yeah, and I can't speak to this individual in particular, but I do think that this shows just the broad power that immigration does have, in the sense of, you know, to the extent someone is here you know, even in a process, the asylum process, that our authorities do have, our immigration authorities do have discretion to determine whether to detain them. I think what this shows is just like how egregious this can be, right? We're talking about a teenager. I also think it's just important to know what we have a project down at the border, and I work with a number of young kids, 18 to 21 year olds, who have are seeking asylum at our border, and they're put in detention for weeks, if not months. So it's not, this is not necessarily an anomaly. It's something that we've seen throughout throughout the country as well. But I think fortunately, I've read that this individual was released from detention and is back with her family in Massachusetts, from what I read.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, all three of you, for joining us for the hour. The voice you just heard, Anna Welch, a professor at UMaine and managing co-director of the Cumberland Legal Aid Clinic, speaking for herself on this hour. Also with us, Moon Mashar, a program manager for the Maine Association for New Americans, a documentary filmmaker and a mental health advocate. And Rilwan Osman, the executive director of the Maine Immigrant and Refugee Services. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can find our past shows and sign up for our free weekly newsletter at mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the show, we're having some fun. We're talking about yoga. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.